Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call this March 6th meeting of the House Education Finance Division to order, please. Representative Carlson, if you want to, we've got a brief moment of business to complete, but if you'd like to set up, that would be great. Representative Erickson, you usually do great diligence on the minutes. Are you in a position? I know you were present yesterday and asked several questions. Are you in a position to make a motion regarding the March 5th minutes?
Well, Mr. Chair, I will move the minutes from March 6th.
My apologies.
So I'll move approval of March 6th. Of March 6th.
Thank you very much. Any discussion to the Erickson motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Carlson, welcome to the committee. The chair will move that House File 789 be before the committee for possible inclusion in a future division report. Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, it's always good to be back. I sat on this committee for many years. I like to point out that I chaired one education committee or another for about 20 years of my time here, so it's good to be back. Although I'm officially still somewhat on the committee, I'm ex-official.
We're aware.
First time I've just sitting in. And I'm here for a business opportunity, if you will, House File 789. And Mr. Chairman, this deals with other post-employment benefit bonds. And back in 2008, the legislature authorized municipalities and school districts to issue general obligation bonds to cover the cost of post-employment benefits. And those were generally health care benefits that were being provided to retirees. What happened, the Robbinsdale School District issued the bonds, but they didn't draw down the earnings on the bonds to pay for the post of benefits. It continued to build in the trust fund, and so they were covering those out of their general budget when they were making the payments. And so what the bill would allow them to do is to draw down $7 million that they would have been able to draw down from the trust to cover those post-retirement benefits. And so I have here both the superintendent, Dr. Carlton Jenkins, and Mr. Hine, the business manager for the Robbinsdale School District, if you would like to read the comments as to what we need to make this historical correction going back to 2008.
Please, Dr. Jenkins, welcome back to the committee.
Hey, thank you so much for having us back here. And I know all these snow days have you as busy as we are on our end. And so we really appreciate you taking the time out to hear from us about this particular House Bill 789. And that's we're coming here before you today. We're looking at where we are. 4 years ago, I arrived in Robbinsdale Area Schools, and we were working through our different financial situations and trying to make sure that we put our district in the right, best fiscal position. And as we were looking at the other post-employment benefits with our new finance manager, we realized that we had not drawn down from our OPEV over the past years. And I will tell you, in Robbinsdale, we've had 12 finance managers over three superintendents. So when you see a situation like that, and then the bill itself changed how we fund it financially and saying that you can draw down and you can put some other positions over in it, like counselors and nurses, things of this nature, sometimes things get lost in translation. And so what we're not asking for other monies, we're just asking for the permission, as was stated, to take our dollars now and use them in the way we see fit in terms of our fund balance and other things alike. But I would really appreciate you acting on this as we've been trying to be fiscally responsible for the last 2 years. We've actually strategically realigned our resources, $17 million in cuts. And so, and as you know, I spoke the last time on cross-subsidy, which in 13-14, the game changed with how we do the cross-subsidy, which within itself is a 77% increase over for where we were in 14-15. So all of this, going line item by line item, we try to make sure we maximize all of our dollars so that we don't have to continue to go into the general fund to do this. And going forward, we really understand where we are, and we're in good hands of Mr. Hines here, our finance manager, and we really would appreciate your support.
Thank you, Dr. Jenkins. Mr. Hines, do you wish to say anything?
No, I think that's been summed up pretty well. The only reiteration I would make is that we're not asking for any additional state money. We're just simply, this would put us in a position of where we would have been had the OPEB funds been drawn on a timely and accurate basis. Also, to go further, there wouldn't be any impact to local taxpayers because even after the draw, the plan will still be more than sufficiently funded, and that's using an expected rate of return, which is less than the state pension plans.
Sir, I just need you to identify yourself.
Oh, thanks. I'm Greg Hine, Finance Director, Robbinsdale Schools.
Thank you, sir. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Hines, when did you begin your service?
I started with Robbinsdale School District in July of 2018.
Thank you.
Anything more, Representative Murphy?
No.
All right. Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Superintendent Dr. Jenkins, thank you for bringing the bill up as well, Representative Carlson, and to Mr. Hines. Absolutely going to support this. I mean, there's no reason why we wouldn't. However, I do have to ask some questions about some fiduciary responsibility. I'm curious how you got here. And so my first question would be, it sounds like you've had to make some cuts during this time. What were there any financial controls that were ignored by previous? How did you get here? I mean, this is a pretty big thing to just oversee or overlook.
Okay.
Dr. Jenkins or Mr. Hine.
But let me just speak to that, and that's a great question, and one of the things that the board and I, we've been working on in terms of trying to make sure that we're good stewards of the money. So I come from a line item by line item, and but having a finance manager 3 different years, this is my 4th year there, and sometimes things have gotten lost. And even in talking to my colleagues prior to coming here about the OPEB funding, many people were not aware of this particular fund that they could draw down. But these are superintendents, not finance managers. And I asked all of them to go back and talk to the finance managers as well to see are they taking advantages of the opportunities with the OPEB dollars.
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you. And
comments on that?
Please.
Mr. Hine.
As far as how did we get here, so again, I arrived in July of 2018. Fiscal year 18 had just closed. I have 20-plus years experience with 4 large districts in the state and 6 years of MDE in finance. So part of the procedure is going through the audit and looking through when I looked to go for the annual OPEB draw. That's when I discovered that the funds had not been drawn in the past as they appropriately should have. How do you prevent that from happening in the future? You have an audit checklist. You go through, you make sure all of the responsibilities and work with the auditors to ensure that all of the closing activities happen on a timely and appropriate basis.
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you. And, you know, please don't take this in the manner that would be poor. I come from a CFO background, so I know the scrutiny, and I know what happens when something is missed a little bit, and suddenly, you know, the pressure just comes down. And so what you just said there, Mr. Hines, isn't the district having, I'm sure you're having audits from outside organizations on a yearly basis. How did they miss this?
Mr. Hunt.
I couldn't really speak to their measures and their protocol. They don't look at everything. It's a limited scope. They look at certain items, and somehow, I can't speak for them, but it probably was not part of their annual audit procedure to ensure that it is incumbent on us, the district, to know the law, to apply it, to do the things accordingly. Do they share some joint responsibility? Perhaps, but primarily the onus would be on the district and the finance director.
Representative Kreshaw?
Okay, thank you. So have you had the same audit firm for the last 8 years?
Yes.
Mr. Hine? Okay. Representative Capriccio?
Thank you. And so when this came into play, that audit firm knew about this, right? They, when this bond was issued, you said it was 7 years ago? How, was that right?
Mr. Hine?
About 10 years ago, 2008, was when the bonds were issued.
Okay. Representative Capriccio?
Thank you. And so when this bond came in, that audit firm knew about this?
Mr. Hine?
Because it would have been a new transaction.
They would have been aware because we needed to create the irrevocable trust fund. Yeah. And the related debt service fund. So, yeah, they were obviously aware that the bonds were issued, that the trust existed, and that there we should have been an appropriate annual draw from that fund to account for the post-retirement benefits costs incurred.
Representative Capriccio.
And thank you. And it just seems to me, that, and nothing on you, I mean, you guys were probably, you trust the auditors, you trust the previous finance. These are all people who said they have experience in this, and they missed it. And I feel bad for you because it put you in a spot where you were probably making cuts. You were doing things. You were probably coming back to the legislature telling us to do funding. And here you had a pocket of money that people should have known because of the way it was set up. I'm sorry this happened to you. I hope you've gone back to your auditing firm and talked sternly to them. There's no way they should have missed this, in my opinion. I mean, that's what they do. But I'll leave it with that. Good luck. You certainly have my vote.
Representative Carlson.
On that point, I just mentioned that Fox, Dr. Jenkins, about the issue a couple, 3 months ago. My reaction to it was to the credit of Mr. Klein, a fresh set of eyes, you know, that picked up on that because, as he pointed out, he didn't start until midsummer 2018. Residents of the district, I have to say thank you to him.
Very good. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Strom, I remember this was Representative Greiling's original bill, at least I think it was. Could you just walk through us how this, we call them, let's see, other post-employment benefits for the acronym OPEB. And then I think we made a change the year after. As I recall, Representative Greiling wasn't too thrilled about what happened. So would you walk us through that, please?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, it would be impolitic to say that the Tax Committee did it to the Education Committee yet again. But this was a provision that was passed in the tax bill and applied when it initially passed and applied to all municipalities, including school districts. And at the time it was passed, it was not seen primarily as a school district funding mechanism. But school districts realized that with the authority to bond without voter approval, that they could quick sell some bonds, put those in the irrevocable trusts, and then in future years have a source of revenue to compensate for the other post-employment benefits that the district had previously agreed to. Relatively few municipalities other than school districts took advantage of that opportunity, but because it essentially created a window for school districts to do this bonding without voter approval, the next year's legislature came back and said, oh, that's not really what we meant, and in the tax committee again then limited the ability to go through the trust mechanism. So school districts after the 2009 change need to get voter approval for any future sale of OPEB bonds. But what was created out of that was an opportunity for school districts to use an annual levy for their prior year's OPEB costs. And I should just mention that the other post-employment benefits consist of two parts. There's the parts for agreements that the district may have had in previous contracts for certain retiree health costs. And then there's what's called the implicit rate subsidy. The state law allows retired employees to remain in the school district health fund. And this has the effect, since they're generally older, of changing the overall balance of that fund. And so the district's study, their actuary study, shows the impact of the retirees in the fund, and the extra cost that that puts on their health costs is referred to as the implicit subsidy. So both of those add together to make the OPEB cost. But the change in 2009 essentially said that if a district wants to bond for this, it'll have to go to the voters first. And for other districts, they were given the annual levy authority, but in order to exercise that authority, the provisions that were in the contract giving rise to the retiree health benefits needed to be modified. So the district still has the obligation for those retired employees covered under former contracts, but going forward, those provisions need to be modified in the district contracts. There is a printout in your folder, and you can see on that printout in the first couple of columns the 80 districts that sold bonds, sold about $700 million of bonds, and then the remaining districts, if they choose, if they have OPEB costs from the prior year, can use the annual levy, and you can see that in the third to last column. The bonded amount is just a little over double the annual levy currently, and the bonded amount isn't going to change out into the future unless a district were to get voter approval to sell those bonds. But the annual OPEB levy is growing from year to year. Sorry for the long answer.
Well, it's
good lesson.
This was a big deal when it happened to local governments of all sorts.
Mr. Chair, yes, and I think the tax committee was not aware of the impact that this would have on the school district levies, because the exception essentially to the voter approval of those bonds was very unexpected.
Interesting. Representative Erickson, thank you for that question. Do you have more?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one final question. So this is voter approved on the tax statement. Does it then fall under that line? Do you know, Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, for the 1 year in which these bonds were issued, none of those needed to be voter approved. So if going forward a district chooses to try to go through the trust mechanism and sell bonds for that, that will be voter approved. It will show up on the tax form as voter approved authority, just like building bonds would. And then on the levy forms that school districts use, and certainly the business manager can speak better to this than me, but on the levy form that school districts use, there are separate lines. There's a separate fund for the bonded debt, and then there's a separate line in the general fund for the annual OPEB payments.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Superintendent, for coming back again, and Representative Carlson. And I'm sorry, I forget our account.
Mr. Hine.
I appreciate you being here. I am a teacher in Robbinsdale. I've been in Robbinsdale now for close to 22 years, and I've enjoyed a wonderful career in the school district. I've seen it really change over the years and become more inclusive, but at the same time really working hard to meet all of the needs of all of our students. This start of this school year, we were almost $17 million deficit, and we felt that pain the minute we walked into the door the day school started. It meant that there were less folks around to help with the students, less resources, much more anxiety, a lot more pressure on our teachers and our administration, our leaders. I've sat down with Dr. Carlton a number of times, and we talked about the struggle that our school district was in and what could we do, what could I do as a legislator. And it's not an easy job. It's not an easy job to be a superintendent. I know Dr. Carlton has worked really hard and looked everywhere in every corner to make sure that our school district has the resources that are available to them and to us, so that we can make sure that every kid is getting the service and the instruction and the resources that they need. So thank you for finding this. Thank you for coming back and asking for this. And I look forward to a number of more years working in the Robbinsdale School District.
Thank you, Representative Kunesh-Podein. Representative Krusha, closing it out.
Thank you. Just a comment. What sparked me, Mr. Strom, you mentioned 80 other districts. Can we send can we have MDE or at least someone send a note out just to make sure nobody else is doing this?
Hopefully they're catching it, and a fresh set of eyes caught it here in Robbinsdale. Superintendent Jenkins.
Well, first of all, again, just thank you for having us, and we just want to make sure that we're making this request. I think it is something that's very important. I do thank you for making that last comment, because as I spoke to my colleagues, a number of them are not quite aware of this. So we come humbly asking for the opportunity to transfer up to $7 million back from our OPEP to our general fund dollars.
Thank you, Superintendent. Representative Carlson, any closing words?
Mr. Chairman, you know, the reference to the deficits, it reminded me of something. When I was first elected, the Robbinsdale Schools was just below 30,000 students, 28,000 something. And if you noticed on the printout, they're at 12,000 students. And so I've kind of commented more than once that part of my legislative career is to try to help school districts with declining enrollment.
Mm-hmm.
And as this committee well knows, it's difficult to manage growing and expanding enrollment, but it's much harder when you're going through year after year of declining enrollment. And I just thought of that with the references to managing a difficult budget situation from time to time through the years.
Yes.
But I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to present mm-hmm. the bill.
Thank you. And with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 789 be held over for possible inclusion in a future division report. Thank you, Representative Carlson. Members, next, we move on to a series of short informational presentations by several of the boards that we oversee and entities, starting with PELSB, the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board. Welcome to the committee. I know I'm going to get it wrong, and I apologize, Mr. Luisi. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alex Liuzzi, Executive Director of the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board. We are a brand new agency. So we were started on January 1st of 2018, so we just completed our first year. We have sort of four areas of oversight, and what I'll do is I'll go through those areas and then also just give you a bit of numbers that attach to each of those areas. So we oversee teacher preparation. Within teacher preparation, we review 31 preparation providers, which includes some alternative pathways now based on some funds that were provided to start up alternative pathways last legislative session. In those 31 teacher preparation programs, there's 826 different licensure program, so we'll often talk about a preparation provider, the sort of the larger unit, and then the preparation programs. Within those, in the 17 and 18 year, we have had an enrollment of 12,431 candidates enrolled in those programs. So that's one area. We have two staff that oversee teacher preparation. Then we issue licenses. We issue teacher licenses, which includes permissions to teach outside of an area or to teach in an innovative program as well. We issue about 11,000 licenses each year and 3,500 permissions every year. That total of issuing, reviewing all that information is about six staff members in that area. And then, of course, licensure renewal. So teacher licensure renewal, we have 21,000 about every year that go through our renewal system. The majority of those we call quick renew. They sort of are able to issue their clock hours and they process through an online system. But 8,000 of those have to be individually pulled for one reason or another and reviewed separately. We have one staff member that does licensure renewal. And then finally, we oversee teacher ethics. We review approximately 1,000 cases per year. And last, I pulled the data for a six-month period last year. Within that period, we opened 176 cases, took action on 30 of them, which was a suspension of some kind, and then 16 cases had a deny or revoke category as well. And we have 1.5 FTE that work on the teacher ethics areas. Additionally, we, unlike many other states, have a very robust customer service presence. If you are in Wisconsin and have a question about your teacher license, you are required to email sort of a general box. We have three customer service reps that take over 27,000 calls per year in Minnesota. We sort of pride ourselves in being able to walk individuals through the complicated licensing process, the complicated permission process, helping them through either paper applications or online applications. So that is another big piece that we do here. Beyond that, we try to support districts and teachers in as many ways as possible. We work very closely with the Department of Education. We do have a lot of overlap there. They oversee teacher development and evaluation pieces, but we have a relationship with that as well, including trying to support teachers through mentorship opportunities. Based on a tiered licensure statute that changed, the board took a very keen interest in helping both teachers and districts try to meet some of those new requirements. So one very clear example is helping develop cultural confidence training that we will be providing in May and June all across the state, specifically to Tier 1 teachers who are required to have that before they can renew their license for next year, knowing that it was sort of a brand new requirement and difficult for districts to be able to get that up and running in time. So we put together a group of experts in cultural competence, developed a training, and we'll be providing it in May and June. This new board is a very active board. There's 11 members currently, and they are excited about their work, and they are excited to get information from experts in the field before making their decisions. So that has meant that they have created over 11 subcommittees up to this point in different areas that they can meet with those experts in those fields, and they bring them information either on changes in rule, suggested changes that we could bring for statute, but giving them more information. Creates a lot of work both for board members and board staff, but we are excited about that opportunity to work with experts in the field. In our first year, we became a new agency. We had a brand new tiered licensure system. We were given the funds to create an online licensure system. That is still under construction, but board staff is moving from paper applications slowly to that new online system, and we are moving in May. So pretty much every area that we could have changed in the past year, we are. It's been an exciting year. We're hoping for a calmer next year. We were very pleased when we became a new agency. This was a combination of both six members at the Board of Teaching and about 12 staff members at the Educator Licensing Division at the Department of Education, that those two groups of staff coming together, that the legislature fully funded this agency. We've been very excited to have that. We have no change items for the budget for the coming year because we have felt very fully funded to be able to do the work that we need to do. So with that, I entertain questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Luizzi. Questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, sir, where are you moving to?
Mr. Luizzi.
Mr. Chair, Representative, a Bandana Square. If you ever went to the model train room at Bandana Square that's been left vacant for a couple years, we are filling it. I know. My kids are upset that I'm...
Does it come with a hat, special hat?
It does not. We're trying to come up with some train teacher metaphors that we could set up. But.
Representative Murphy anymore. But all right. You killed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next on our agenda is the Purpose Center for the Arts. Dr. Trigestad. Dr. Trigestad, please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony. Thank you for being here today.
Just pull up. I have a PowerPoint.
Yes, there is a PowerPoint slide deck in your packet, members.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving us this time to come back and talk about the work that we've been doing at the Purpose Center for the last year. Just as a point of reference, I've been the executive director there for just over 18 months after having served as a school superintendent in Minnesota for the previous 15 years and a principal before that. My first job in education was as a band director for 16 years in Minnesota as well. So I've been asked to provide some background information on Purpich, you know, our role with regards to K-12 education, how we fit into the state budget, and also provide some updates on how we're redesigning our agency into one that provides even higher value to our state. Just as a point of reference, the Purpich Center was formed in 1985 by, obviously, Governor Purpich and his wife, Lola. They got the idea from in between his terms. I lived in Vienna and saw this type of education institution, thought it would be a good thing for Minnesota. And so it came back. It's been through a number of different names. It started off in St. Paul in 1989, moved to the Golden Valley site. And it remains as one of the school choice pieces in the state of Minnesota. PSEO, charter schools, open enrollment all came to the fore in those number of years. And it is one of the choices that's there for our parents. One of the things I have found in the last 18 months is people don't know a lot about us, and some people don't even know where we're located. So just a quick orientation. We are located just west of the intersection of Highway 100 and Highway 55 in Golden Valley on the former Golden Valley Lutheran campus. We have a campus of 33 acres. These are a couple of Google Earth shots just to kind of orient you. We have an athletic field. We do have an agreement with Groves Academy, so our students do have access to activities. In the foreground is our education building. The top center is where our professional development division works, and on the upper right is our dormitory. In the main campus, you'll see there's a newer building and an older building. The new building was built approximately in 2000. It houses a small performance hall, all of our academic classrooms, and the music and theater departments, and a gallery. The older section has the library, the cafeteria, offices, studios, a black box theater, and a dance studio. So very much oriented toward the work that we do. So just some quick facts about us. We are a state agency and part of the executive branch. We have a board of directors of 15 members that are appointed by the governor, and they are to represent every part of our state. And we also have a MDE liaison that serves on our board as well, and that has taken place since the last bill went through. We're funded biennially by appropriation and bonding. We have a total of 63 employees. Organizationally, we're made up of three divisions, professional development and resources, our library, and the arts high school. One of the pieces that the legislative auditor's report pointed out 2 years ago was that the Purpose Center did not have a strategic plan. So one of the first things that happened when I came to the organization is the board sat down with a facilitator and myself, and we created a strategic plan. And that remains in place, and it is our guiding document. We want to be the statewide arts education leaders. We want to have operational excellence, financial stability, positive public image, and robust enrollment. And those are the pieces that we work toward every day. So I want to speak a little bit to each one of the divisions that we have out there. Resource Magnet Outreach Programs is the language that the statute uses. Internally, we refer to it as professional development and resources. The goal of that group is to build teacher and administrator capacity so they can provide innovative, inclusive, standards-based, measurable, and student-centered learning in and through the arts. Just know that FY18 was a year of transition for that group based on the decisions made by our board, as was pointed out in the legislative audit report. Two programs were closed. Perpich Arts Integration Network for Teachers, or what was called PAINT, was a program that worked with non-arts teachers to implement arts into their core subjects, or a more common name for it now is STEAM. It was pointed out that was outside of our purview. And the Turnaround Arts Program is a program for elementary schools. It's a national program. There are seven elementaries in Minnesota that were turnaround schools. We continue the program till the end of the year, and it's being currently managed by the Department of Education. So we have three basic areas in the PDNR: professional development, our comprehensive arts planning process, and the professional arts library. So our major initiatives this year, first of all, we knew that we needed to be able to reach the entire state with our professional development. We took a page out of the playbook from the Department of Education and the Regional Centers of Excellence and struck up a conversation and an agreement with the Regional Service Co-ops. The service is our home away from home. They've been very good to work with. We have access to their facility, to their technology, and they also have agreed to supply any communications to their member districts that we supply them. We've also created a regional arts teacher leader network and a pilot demonstration school model. The comprehensive arts planning process was started, and we've also been active with the Department of Education in redoing the art standards that you probably will be seeing in the near future. So a couple words about the Regional Arts Teacher Leader Network. I have six people that work in that division. Six people cannot meet the needs of, I know, 4,000 music teachers in the state of Minnesota. There's nearly that many art teachers. There are fewer dance and theater. We needed to engage the teachers in the regions to find out what they needed. So we put out a request for applications to teachers around the state with the goal of having a representative from each region be part of this teacher leader network. They had to apply, their administrator had to support that, and they had to agree to attend four training sessions. Luckily, that was funded by a National Endowment for the Arts grant, and we worked on things like leadership, advocacy, communication, and pedagogical knowledge. And that has been a very positive work so far. They have become our advocates. I call them our boots on the ground. They're the ones that tell us what their teachers need. It's not us telling them what we think they need. And we intend to continue and expand this program moving forward. They also were eligible as a part of the Teacher Leader Network to host a demonstration school. Before I do that, in your packet, you do see there's a list there of, by region, how many teachers and what areas they teach in the Regional Arts Teacher Leader Network. I'll tell you, the one thing that we struggle with is that when you get outside of the metro and the regional centers, it's very difficult to find dedicated arts theater teachers and dance teachers that work, you know, full-time or part-time as dance teachers in the schools. So just know that we have also reached out schools that that have people who do extracurricular theater things are eligible for our training, as well as many of our schools provide the dance standards in their Phi-Ed courses. And so the Phi-Ed teachers are invited and encouraged to be a part of this process and the training as well. Our demonstration schools are a means to have teachers teach teachers. I know, the data and the research shows that teachers learn best by watching their peers and conversing about it. So the goal here is that at least one, and hopefully expanded in the future, one time they can go to someone in their region, to a master teacher, we'll call, and be able to watch that teacher teach in their classroom and see how they interact with kids and find out how they did it. Hopefully they can take something back. Then our staff, the art specialists, will work with that group to debrief about what they saw, how they can take that back to their classrooms. And then in the afternoon, we also provide additional professional development. So we try to make this really useful to each of the participants. And we also believe we're building capacity by creating teacher leaders out in the state, across the state. The list you have there shows that these are the pilot demonstration schools for this year. They are located in every part of the state, and we hope, again, to expand this moving forward. But doing it the first time around, we want to make sure we do it right and not overreach our abilities to support it well. All of this work is supported by our music, visual arts and media, theater, and dance arts content specialists. They do all the workshops for us. They do curriculum development, assessment design. They will be working with rolling out the new academic standards when they are approved, workshops, etc. And just know that the Purpose Center does not charge for those workshops at any level. Yeah, we are being funded by you, the state, and the taxpayers to provide that service. And we, and I know, as a former superintendent, it's difficult to send a teacher out and pay that sub cost and not alone have to pay some kind of a fee on top of it. So we don't do that. If there's any fee, it's with the service co-op for refreshments or a meal. So just know that that is our work, and we continue to do it, and we'll do it. One of the other things that, that we have implemented is that our art specialists will provide at least one on-site workshop in each region each year. We don't believe that they should have to travel to the metro every time they need to get something from us. And so there's a list of what we've set aside this year, and again, that will expand. And I would just say, as I've shared with others, we're building the plane as we fly it to a certain extent here, and we want to do this larger and more expansive across the state, but we're taking our time in doing it. So what impact have we had? Well, in the first 6 months, we've had contact with 171 districts. And if you take those 171 districts, they serve over 500,000 students at 71% of the state. We've had direct face-to-face contact with 1,359 arts teachers, it's 87 non-arts, and 44 administrators. And again, the non-arts are probably the PE and theater folks that have been a part of it. We break up our services in a continuum. Tier one is a breakout session at a convention or conference where we have an hour to 4 hours. Tier two is a day long. Tier three, multi-day. And four is a situation where we go into a district and we will help them rebuild or recreate a curriculum. Say we need a new K-6 arts art in the classroom curriculum. That's our work. We go in and help them develop it as a resource. Again, hopefully saving money for that district because they're not going out and hiring a consultant elsewhere. Moving on to the, and just a quick note, the percent of contacts in the last 6 months, you'll see that 34% of us were those quick hit things at tier one, but tiers two through four were the majority of our work, which means we're doing deep work with those folks. The Comprehensive Arts Planning Program is also stipulated in statute that we provide. I tell you that it was closed in 2012 for some reason and was not functioning, so we're resurrecting this program. And so this year we put out some feelers for schools that had plans that wanted to redo them soon and also would help us rebuild the program, find out what was done well before, and continue on. In fact, Robbinsdale is one of the schools that is working with us this year, and Superintendent Jenkins. So we're very happy for that. So we provide a facilitator, and we provide $2,500 per year for 2 years to help them develop their plan. One of the key parts of this is that that committee at the local level has to be made up of not only school people, but also community people. They need to decide what they want the arts to look like in their communities. And it's basically strategic planning for the arts. We put out application materials for next year, and we hope to have another 8 to 12 districts involved. Our library, as you might remember from the report from the legislative auditor, that was one of the criticisms. There was a flood. They packed up the library. They moved it to another building. So about half of it wasn't available for about 3 years. We remodeled, redid our library space. That moved back into our main building. And the entire library is available, not only for our students, but we also have a large professional lending library available to the arts teachers across the state. And that's some rather unique items. So another big area that we have is the Arts High School, as you might imagine. We are a comprehensive tuition-free public high school for 11th and 12th graders. We offer an advanced curriculum. We have advanced placement courses and college and school courses, as well as unique courses that are required that are infused with the arts standards. We have six areas, the ones that I've already mentioned, plus literary arts and media arts. And we do have the dorm, the residential hall option for qualifying students. So when we look at the students that are there right now, our accepted students average have a 3.28 GPA coming in. Our ACT scores from last year were above the state and the national average. We've had a five-year graduation rate of 98%. Our graduates go on to post-secondary institutions at about a 75% rate. And one of the things that, we've seen in talking with the counselor is we have some more kids taking gap years all the time. So that figure gets distorted a little bit. I believe that the majority of our kids do eventually go back for a post-secondary experience of some kind. What's interesting is that this last year we had more kids that, left the state and went to either Coast or Chicago for their post-secondary, and they went to rather prestigious institutions at a very high rate. Nine went to Manhattan alone. So for our high school, we have three points of emphasis that we're working on this year. Obviously, student admissions, I'll talk about in a second. Partnership development, through some of the situations that happened in the past, we lost some partnerships, we lost some communication. We are rebuilding those partnerships because we need to be talking with Hennepin Theater Trust, we need to be talking with the Guthrie, we need to be talking with the Institute of Art. Those are our resources for us, and we can help them and they can help us. And so we're developing that as well. To say nothing about rebuilding our relationships with the college universities and public schools across the state. And lastly, we have a Purpose 2.0 project that I'll share a little bit. So our challenges. Public perception after the legislative audit report and the 2016 session. Our student enrollment is not where we want it to be. I will be just blunt about that. We're at 118 students, and it is not enough. But I would add a couple data points to that. This year's seniors would have been making their decision whether to come to Purpich during the legislative session 2 years ago when there was a lot of question whether Purpich would survive or not. This year's juniors would have been making their decision between 6 and 8 months after the end of that session. And there was a fair amount of public relations negativity that went on with that. I can't tell you how often I've been at, say I'm from the Purpich Center, and I get a response, oh, I thought you guys closed. And so we have to retell our narrative, and then we've been working very hard to do that. But I do believe that it has affected our enrollment. That's the hardest thing to turn around, that public perception. I know that from working in public schools and you know, districts, as well as this position. We have an increasing number of kids with special needs. Special education has tripled in the last 3 years. We have mental health needs like every other school, Section 504 plans. And just know that that's all general fund for us. We receive no state special ed. And likewise, we don't have many of those funding streams that the other public schools in the state have since we're an appropriation base. We also have a challenge of recruiting a student body that reflects our state better, and we're working on that as well. There is a teacher shortage everywhere. We have trouble finding teachers and retaining them. Technology, I just have to say that the last time we had an infusion of technology for students was 2011. So we're about at the end of the rope with that. And bonding for facilities, we don't have access to long-term facilities maintenance or other dedicated funding streams that other public schools have. So how are we responding? We have a lot of direct recruitment. We have an admissions coordinator. We have a lot of events we've attended. I won't go through them. Our communications director has worked very aggressively. New materials, we have become a presence on social media because we know that's where the kids are, and many of our younger parents are as well. We have a new website coming up and, again, rebuilding those relationships. We also have been out there at events letting people know that Purpich is still there. So, we want to continue working on forging those new partnerships. And the last thing I will mention before I close is that we are undertaking a process with the high school of looking at literally who we are and how we function. We know we're an arts high school, but if any of our other high schools in the state haven't changed dramatically in 20 years, we'd be talking about some issues. We haven't changed appreciably in 20 years. And so we're talking with our kids, our parents, our stakeholders, our critical partners about what do you need from us? What niche can we fill? What can we do to improve Perpich and have it go on in perpetuity? That process is going on this year. I see us coming back with some language requests in another year to talk about how we can grow and change. And so in closing, I would say that, again, we're flying the plane and building it at the same time, but there are some very positive things happening. Our number of applicants is up 30% over last year. Of the 118 kids we have there this year, 72 are new to the campus this year. So I think that we're building some momentum toward getting back to that 200-plus enrollment that we need. And so with that, I'll close. And thank you,
Dr. Trierstad. Representative Murphy, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Several. In your strategic plan, how have you addressed enrollment?
Dr. Trierstad?
Representative Murphy, Mr. Chair, we have a communications plan that we've shared with our board, and we have a communications committee that meets, I believe, bi-monthly or even weekly at this time of year to determine what we need to do right now to move forward. But we've really changed how that has happened. I would just add that during the time when there was incredible declining enrollment, we had no admissions coordinator on campus. So it was all kind of just happening on its own. So we've taken a lot of steps to shore that up.
Representative Murphy?
I think that's a good thing. Can you break down the enrollment that you have now? Are there students from every congressional district?
Dr. Trierstad?
I'm sorry. Representative Murphy, Mr. Chair. Yes, there are representatives from every congressional district. As you might imagine, 7 is the least active with us because of distances, but we do have 4 students from there.
Representative Murphy.
That's good, too, and that's good news. And then you talked about the increase in the last 3 years. You said special ed, students with special ed needs has tripled. And so is that because people have heard that this is a good place for them to succeed at? Or do you have a reason? Or is it just such few people's numbers that such few students you don't have an analysis?
Sure. Dr. Trierstad.
Thank you for the question. It's hard for me to answer what might have happened before I got there. I do know that my direction to my staff is that we are a public school. If students apply, we can't be choosy and we can't determine or filter who can apply and who can attend based on any kind of either high academic need or low academic need. And so I think that we see more students because it's more accessible to them right now. The other piece that I believe is, as we know, the numbers of special ed kids in the state has increased, and I think that's would be a normal change for us as well. It's not uncommon to see high-functioning ASD students, autism spectrum disorder students, be highly talented in one of the arts. The two sometimes can work together. So I think we're starting to see some of those students where Perpich might be the perfect place for them because of their needs, but it has increased our needs, and we've had to add special ed staff and paras, at ERA, I should say, to meet that need.
Representative Murphy, any further questions?
No, Mr. Chair, I think this has been a good report, and we can go forward together.
Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Trierstad. I just want to follow up on Representative Murphy's. I share her sentiment. I think this is positive, and I'm glad you're coming and being honest. But I want to understand the acceptance process a little bit. You put in here accepted students carry. So walk me through the application process.
Sure. Dr. Trierstad. Yeah.
Mr. Krisha and Mr. Chair, the process starts with application time going up to February 1st was the initial time. We have several, I believe there were seven information sessions that we held either on a Saturday or right before one of our performances in the evening to show kids and families what the place was like. We have been active in reaching out to schools and counselors, but I will tell you that we do not direct market to students, and we don't mail out everywhere. So if there's been some interest sent back to us, then we obviously follow up with additional interest. So if you are a student and you applied by the 1st of February, then there is a date that's set where they come, and it's not an audition, but it's a process where they go through with four adults, two or three being from Purpich, one from the outside, a stakeholder, that looks at the student's portfolio. Are they serious about their art? Is this going to be a good fit for them, et cetera? And we have traditionally had about a 75% acceptance rate. So not everyone that applies is accepted. And it could be because of GPA as well. You know, that could be another eliminator. So that happens. We go through that process. There's another period of application after that. This year it ends on April 15th, and we'll have another date audition, you know, date after that. So by the 1st of June, we send out the invitations to those students that have been accepted, and then most times we get them all to come here, but there's nothing saying that they have to either. They could still stay in their home district or choose another district.
So. Representative Krisha?
Thank you. A couple more follow-ups, and thank you for that. So, and I'm just, I understand the tough spot it must be in the admissions process. So, barriers to applying, one of the things that you said was you don't direct market. Are there other barriers that students may have to why they wouldn't apply?
I think distance is one. And having parents that would be willing to bring them in. You know, they stay for three weekends a month, and we make them go home for one. We close the door for one weekend a month. Another would be transportation locally. We don't have a transportation system, so we rely either on commuters or the Metro bus system, which does have one stop out there at 7:30 in the morning. Another is the cost of the dorm, which up until recently has been $3,600 for students. And we have always had a financial aid sliding scale for that. Our board, from the time I got there, recognized that for outstate especially, that fee was a barrier. And so our board decided to waive that fee for anyone from 20 miles or further away. We base that number and the plan on similar state systems elsewhere, Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, etc. And so the idea there is that when we looked at the data, just in short, the kids that were coming from outstate were the ones who were paying the full price and not tapping into the financial aid, which said to us that the kids that that needed the aid just saw it as an impossible thing and just didn't apply. And I believe that's part of our uptick. I don't have the number on how many at this time, but I believe that's probably one of the largest barriers.
Representative Krisha.
Thank you. And so that helps me a lot. And I, to the test part, let me ask it this way. So it's interesting we're going through this, and I saw you say in here, a student body that better reflects the demographics of our state. So help me reconcile this. This is a hypothetical I'm just going to run you through, or maybe it's not. Maybe you go through this. But in some elements, this is like a private school. If you're paying for, there are elements there that are similar to that. And obviously, you want to discriminate between the students that can be successful there and those that cannot. If I applied, you should deny me. There's no question in my mind. No matter what I say, do, or whatever, there's no way I should be in because I won't be successful. But not every student and parent is probably going to see it that way. And so I'm wondering, how do you reconcile that? Here we're doing state dollars. We're doing this for similarities of a private school, and I'm not trying to make judgments there. I'm just drawing the similarities. But then yet you have to be successful, and you have to deny some kids, I'm assuming, because you have to make judgment calls. How are you reconciling all of that And then your enrollment numbers are going down. And so I'm just trying to figure this all out in the tough spot you're in.
Dr. Trigestad.
Thank you, Representative Grisham, Mr. Chair. I think that the process has evolved over all 30 years of the school being there. And there are some definitive measures that they put in place, but it is not an exact science. It can't be, but that's why we have four people that sit on that committee that are involved with the arts and involved with the education, as well as our own administration, that come to the best decisions they can. But yeah, it's a different issue than any other public school in the state has.
Representative Creation, please.
Thank you, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the indulgence. One other follow-up. So, any legacy money, any arts, and are you able to tap into that? Have you gotten any?
So, to my knowledge, there was a point where there were some legacy dollars that was being used, I think, for the Turnaround Arts program at one time, and those monies are no longer available to us. So we do not get legacy dollars.
Representative Grisham.
And I'll just ask, why do we know why they're not available? And then I'll be done. Thank you, Chair.
I don't have that answer. There was a process that happened 3 years ago, 2 years ago, where that was decided it wasn't appropriate.
Thank you.
Thank you. Members, we do have two more entities coming before us today, the State Academies for the Deaf and the Blind and the Board of School Administrators. So I'd like to wrap this up in about 5, 6, 7 minutes and then move on to those other entities. So, Representative Erickson, and there are several others on the list.
And thank you, Mr. Trigstick, for being here. Would you talk a little bit about your teaching staff and the type of license, for example, other special permissions among your staff? Are they involved in the tier system now? Will you talk a little bit about that, how many staffers and how they probably fulfill our licensure requirements?
I'm going to add, Representative Erickson, Mr. Chair. Don't hold me to this exact number, please. I believe we have 21 teachers. They are all licensed as per, that's the law. I believe that we have one permission for a arts teacher to teach an AP arts course. But otherwise, all are in good standing.
Representative Erickson?
I don't have the numbers on how many, where they are in the tiers.
Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my last question is, are you a member of a national organization? Because whenever I Google our Purpich High School, you don't show up on the web pages that show all these outstanding arts high schools across the nation. So I wondered if you belong to a national organization.
Representative Erickson, Mr. Chair, we belong to the Arts School Network. Over 200 schools nationally, and I'm happy to say that I was just named to their governing board, and so we will have a higher profile moving forward. And I look at that as an advantage for our state, that I'm going to get to know and see these other programs up close and get to learn from the best. So, yes.
Representative Erickson?
Just one final question. Perhaps you could provide us with, and maybe there's an annual report coming out, with some of that data about your teaching staff. How many have Tier 4, 3, 2, 1, and are they still in special permissions like community experts until this year ends? So perhaps you could provide us with that. And, I noticed that 75 of your 116 students are from the metro area. That's very interesting that they're seeking out this school rather than perhaps using our universities. Thank you.
Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to hurry in the essence of time here. But thank you, Dr. Trigstad, for being here. And I recognize that the situation that you came into 18 months ago following the OLA report and the challenges that you have faced. And first off, I want to commend you on the test results and the graduation results that you have seen. And some of the barriers that you mentioned, those aren't going to change with respect to the enrollment numbers. And I understand, how many parents and students may have thought that Purpich closed based on some of the reporting that came out at the time. But, from the time that, from when PERPICH first came to be. There are a number of other arts-related options that parents and students have with charter schools and performing arts schools, and also with the success that you've had with the other two areas, the library and the professional development. I mean, I just have to say it. At some point, do we look at the arts high school and say we would be better off putting our resources to the other two areas than continuing the focus on the arts high school? I mean, if you were sitting in our chairs here, what should we expect in enrollment? Small increases, low? You know, I guess I just need to kind of hear from you what your thoughts are, because at some point we're going to have to continue to have difficult discussions on this topic.
Dr. Trigestad. Representative Juergens, Mr. Chair, I don't disagree with you that if we don't improve those numbers, there are tough discussions to come. I do believe that we are reaching that crest of maybe getting over the hump with this. The one difference that I can really say that we have versus the charter schools is that our kids go to the academics in the morning, but they get a 3.5 to 4 hour deep dive into their art areas in the afternoon. And that doesn't happen in their home high schools, nor do I believe it necessarily happens in the college setting. So it's a unique setting for those kids that really want to develop their skills moving forward. As far as enrollment looking forward, our goal is to be at 200 in 2 years. Now, whether we make that or not, but that's the goal. That's the point where we start financially looking much better on a per-student basis. And if we are looking, hopefully, at 100-plus per class moving forward, we can get there.
And just a quick follow-up. And I can understand that, and I can appreciate the focus that the students have on their arts area. And I think that the results speak for themselves with the graduation and where some of these students are going. So I think it works, but it's expensive. And you know, some of the areas that you, because you're a state agency, you don't qualify for special ed in some of the others. But if you also look at a per pupil basis, I don't even know what it is, and we don't need to go there right now, but it's higher than most of the other schools in the state too. So I think we're seeing terrific results with the students that are there. But again, at some point, it's a cost-benefit analysis we have to take a look at. Thank you for being here.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Trigstad. In terms of open enrollment, let's say if I'm a student in another public school and I compete in music or whatever with the State High School League, does the school also fall under the Minnesota State High School League eligibility rules?
Dr. Trigestad?
Representative Detmer, Mr. Chair, we are a member of the High School League. We have, as I said, an activities agreement with Groves Academy where our students participate in sports-related activities with them. We sometimes have some speech people that do the speech, but that's kind of the extent of our competition at the High School League level.
Representative Detmer?
Thank you. And finally, Mr. Chair, so if a student comes in and is part of your school but then wants to go back to their other school, they would have ineligibility if they're competing in a Minnesota State High School League activity.
I believe that's how the rule would work, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Closing comment, Representative Sandstreet.
Thanks. Just a quick comment in response to something Representative Erickson mentioned in requesting maybe a report on the tiered licensure. I think that's probably very much in line with what Representative Kunesh Podin had recommended, and I think it would be good actually for all of our schools, not just PERPICH. So,
thank
thanks.
You very much. So, Dr. Trigestad, thank you for being here today.
Well, thank
we
you
appreciate
very much
the
for
time.
And your questions.
Superintendent Wilding.
Yes, state agency.
Sorry, Tony. And I stand corrected. This is for the state academies. Superintendent, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you and good morning. I appreciate the opportunity to come here. My name is Terry Wilding. I am the superintendent for the Minnesota State Academies. We oversee two campuses in the Faribault area, one for the blind school and one for the deaf school. They're about 1 mile apart from each other in the town of Faribault. Just wanted to share some information about who we are and what we do. As you can see, we're similar to the Purpich School. We serve students from all over the state of Minnesota. We are one of the oldest schools in Minnesota. We were established in 1858, so we started serving students in 1863 because of the Civil War at that time. So we have been in operation for over 150 years. We serve specifically deaf and blind students. That is in statute. We are 100% a special ed school. All of our students are on individual education plans, IEPs. Every student has specific goals and objectives that we are required to serve and meet. We serve students from a large age gap, as young as 18 months. We start classes as they go to school, and we have students as old as 21 in our transition program on both campuses. The reason for that is we have unique needs. Our students, for example, deaf as babies, they're born into a family that probably has never met a deaf adult before. They don't know how to communicate with their child, and we help them to learn that in everyday things. As we start that connection early at 18 months, we work with families in their homes to support them. We provide them opportunities for language development, social opportunities at the school. That's why we start at 18 months. So at that point, we reduce the gaps that may appear later. We reduce those learning deficiencies. If they know their language development from 0 to 5, that's the most critical period of time for language. We start early, so we address those gaps. We serve students in different locations. As he had mentioned, in the Purpich area, our programs are 1/3 of our students live in our dormitories during the week, and the rest of them are day students that live with their families. The challenge that we're seeing more often, not only deaf and blind, but we also have deaf-blind students that have double disabilities and also additional needs. So our model has changed. We are increasing the types of supports that we give. We have more individual attention. There may be a therapy dynamic that we need to provide that is included in their educational plan. We are unique because our teachers are all trained and proficient with deaf and blind. There are places in schools across the state that do not have that qualified teacher. So 2% and 1% in the state also have, there's 2,500 deaf students, to give you numbers, and about 500 blind students in the state. And we have less than 100. So it's a low incidence, and it's a low awareness, and it's a low expertise area. We can fill those gaps to local school districts by providing our programs, plus giving educational opportunities to those school districts throughout the state. For resources that we have available, we partner with Minnesota Department of Education for resources and trainings throughout the state, whether that be for teachers, professional development, interpreters, all the areas that would apply to our two schools. We also provide the residential option. In Minnesota, it's a large state. Not everyone can daily commute. So we do provide the opportunities for our students to come to school. We have that learning opportunity and language development opportunity into the evenings. Most students come on Sunday evening or Monday morning, and they stay with us until the school week is over, and they go home on Fridays. That gives them time to spend with their families. We do have weekend events occasionally on campus where students do stay, but in generally speaking, they do go home on the weekends. We work with school districts to provide transportation. Our students' families do not pay to come to our school. As Purpage, we are a state-funded. There is no cost tuition for our students to attend. We work with school districts to make sure that they receive what they need. Another positive of our residential program, so the learning doesn't stop at 3 o'clock. Our schools close at 3. The learning doesn't. We provide opportunities after school in different extracurricular activities, learning everyday life opportunities into the evening with our dormitories. Our dorm staff also receive special training on how to support our blind and deaf children and have educational opportunities occurring in the evening. So your families at home talk about different topics, news, weather, budgeting, shopping. All of those things and that information is presented to our students in the dormitory opportunities from our staff. They may not receive the ability to communicate well with their families when they return home on the weekends, so we provide those opportunities for them during the week in their dorms and their daily life. We have a normal school program. We have classes 8 to 3 every day, as you can see our schedule. There's specifics that we do support. We have unique programs in our school that most schools do not have. We have a birth to two home visit program for deaf students. So we go into the homes, we support the family on how to communicate with their child, how do they teach their child, how do you build that relationship with their child. We also have early childhood programs, 18 months up to age 5. In that program, we have the opportunity to develop the social skills that are needed. As language, they are learning. It's not learned in a vacuum. They socialize with other adults. They also have peers their same age. So that language development is critical in our preschool program. We have a living skills program. Career education. Adaptive technology to fit each student's needs. We have expanded our transition program this last year. Many parts of the state are working hard in improving their transition from school to work or to college. And many of those programs are not accessible to our deaf and blind children. Often they face barriers. We are trying to develop programs where we teach students how to address those barriers, how to live through that, how to find the supports and the resources in their environment to go around those barriers. We do provide the same opportunities as other public schools. We have the same curriculum, the same standards, the same state testing, the same PSEO options. We have a good partnership with the Faribault Public Schools, where some of our students take specific coursework, AP courses. They will attend Faribault Public Schools and partner with them and have daily classes down there. As you can see, we are a fully special ed school, so we have a wide range of support services that are required. Mental health staff, therapy. We also have ASL instruction, American Sign Language instruction, so deaf people can learn the communication they are needed to succeed in education. We have speech services for students so they can learn auditorily or how to say certain words. We also have occupational and physical therapy. We have orientation and mobility that teaches our blind students how to navigate into the world. We have Braille instruction. There's many services, and a variety of our services are inclusive into the classroom. We push into the classroom, and we support teachers in there. We also have students that are pulled out and have one-on-one instruction and more specific training. For our campus, We are a small, little community. We have support services in different ways. We are required to provide mental health. We have nutrition. We have physical plant needs, information and technology, interpreting staff department, and security. Our parents trust us. They send their children to us from far away. We need to make sure that our campus is safe. We are heavy to try and include our parents and families into our school. That's one of our biggest factors to support our families so they can succeed at home. In different ways, we try to include families, whether it be learning to how to support their child at home, also improving our after-school programming. In talking specifically about financing, as this applies to your committee. As Purpich explained, we are a state-funded program. We are allocated. All of our budget depends on the finance that is allocated by the legislature every 2 years. We are not able to do any other funding, stream, source, or revenue, such as levy or other grants. We are very limited, and our money comes from you and your support. We do work with some school districts to cover a few individual costs for our students, such as transportation and other things. We do get some federal money, but the majority of our budget is through the allocation biennially from you. Our bonding and construction projects. We do not have the ability to bond ourselves, so we work together with the legislative process to make sure that we are funding the necessary needs to keep our campus up to date. Our campus is 150 years old, so many of our buildings that are very old, I think our oldest building, we just finished in 1906, so that is quite a few years old. Something that we have ongoing issues with is maintenance with our buildings to make sure that we still have accessibility to meet our current ADA codes. And then at some points, we do have to look at and make the decision to replace the building instead of renovating it. And that is something that we work with you as the legislators to plan out. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Currently, we had developed our 5-year strategic plan last year. We are looking at different areas of improvement of our services. 10 years before I arrived, which was 3 years ago, the funding model for MSA was flatlined. And at that time, when the budget was flatlined, that meant cuts to our program because costs went up every year. We ended up becoming more isolated in the Faribault area. We lost connections with many of the districts and the people throughout outstate. We are trying to build back those relationships again, letting people who we are and letting them know how we can support them in different ways throughout the state of Minnesota. We're trying to rebuild some programs, be more innovative in how we present our educational opportunities for our students. We're trying to build in some things. For example, what we are doing now in our transition program, as I just discussed, we are looking at career exploration, doing more experience for our students. Often in their life, they don't have those experience opportunities. To expand that transition program, this summer we are hosting a transition program for deaf students. That is a 2-week program. Public schools have those programs in their community where they can have work experiences at a local grocery store. Our students don't have those opportunities, so we're trying to build in. So we're hosting a 2-week program this summer in June to support the deaf and hard of hearing students all over the state to come to our campus and be able to shadow work in those options of different work experiences. As I mentioned, our strategic plan, we're building those relationships with districts and programs. We're trying to make sure that we have a unified effort. We can't do this alone. We know we can't. We're working together with many different partners and people throughout the state to support our students. As you speak of licensure and professional development, we're trying to increase our training opportunities, our mentoring opportunities, becoming a resource for teachers and other professionals in the school districts throughout the state. We host different workshops on our campus for teachers, mental health staff, interpreters. 2 days ago, we had a mental health workshop. We had 30 mental health professionals that work with deaf children on our campus for a two-day training. That is an example of the things that we are accomplishing. Our strategic plan, we have 5 areas that we are working on. Ongoing improvements of our instruction and our assessment team. We believe that we can do better. We're looking in different ways to improve our instructional potential. As we face assessments, many of those assessments out there are not accessible. For blind students, they can't do many of the tests on the computer. And we also have different challenges that we face. So we're working to improve those testing opportunities, how we measure our progress with our students, making sure that it is appropriate and that the cultural knowledge is there. Increasing our statewide visibility and relationships to be supportive to districts throughout the state. Third, mentioning our transition. Our fourth category is our climate with our community. Our parents, our families, making sure that we are meeting each student's individual needs, making sure that we have a better understanding of their family's perception and what the family needs to support that child, growing our capacity to make sure that we are gaining that feedback and listening to our parents. Student life, that focuses on our after-school opportunities and our work experience that we are providing to our students across age levels. If you're wanting more details, that is posted on our website. You can read our strategic plan on what avenues we are facing and what we are doing. So in summary, what we're asking for this year as the legislative session continues, there's 3 categories that we are focusing on. Our biannual budget, you have the governor's recommendation, and you can see what we are asking for. That covers our operational costs, our benefits, our salaries for our staff. Also covers what we are asking for is a renewal of our technology initiative. 4 years ago, the legislature approved and passed and gave us money to improve our technology infrastructure. We were able to have the deaf and blind students who require more special technology support, more communication systems that are set up. We have used those different programs and been successful in the last 4 years. But obviously, as technology changes, there's more needs that are needed. So we're asking for a renewal of that. Currently, we're working on a mass communication system so our kids can know when there's issues. In a public school, you have an intercom system where messages are sent out, there's emergency alerts, people know when things are happening in the school. Our students do not have access to an intercom system. We don't have ways to communicate with our students. We may have a light on a wall that flashes, but many of our students don't know what that color light means. A yellow light could mean a warning. Is it a bad weather? Is it a warning of a lockdown? There's many things a warning could mean. So how we send out those messages is a mass communication system. We want it accessible to the deaf, as well as our blind students have a different need. So our mass communication system has to fit all of those communication styles and modes. We have started that process. We have a new dorm project that was opened this last fall. In that new dorm, we've established a mass communication system. It is working well. Now we need to phase that in to both of our campuses throughout all of our buildings. That money is needed to continue those phases. So we can alert our students when something is happening on campus. The third part of our budget is the expansion of services. We are looking to 1 new position. We have IEP service requirements. And when those students have IEPs, The students have certain requirements of services that are documented. We can't deny those services because we don't have the money or we don't have the staffing. We are federally required to provide those services. At that point, our staff are trying to meet all of our students' IEP requirements related to the minutes that are documented in those. We are also asking for 4 more school days. Students have additional requirements with state testing. The time periods in public school, testing may take 2 or 3 mornings a year, a few hours. They miss class. For our students, because of the accessibility issues, it may take 2 weeks for them to complete a test. It takes a very long time to go through, especially for our blind students, to take those tests. So we're trying to get more school days to accommodate for that loss of instructional time. That's our operational budget. We also have some other bonding requests that are going through the legislature. We're asking for different projects. 3 of them. There's a safety security corridor. We have 3 main buildings on the deaf school campus. Those 3 buildings where our classes are and students' services are needed, we do not have a central location for them to check in. Each building is in isolation. So if a stranger comes into a building, they may be able to bypass a secretary, and that's dangerous for our students. We have students, like I mentioned, that are 18 months old, 3 and 5 years old. Very easily they could be taken. So we're asking for money to make those connections of our 3 buildings so we can establish a central point where all visitors, strangers, parents, families have to come in and check in to that central point, verify their needs to why they need to be in there, and before they have access to our students. That project is the first one we are asking for. The second bonding project is our dorms at the blind school. They were built before ADA accommodations were needed. Our blind students have very physical challenges, and their ability to use their space is very limited. It is not a well-designed building. The communication system is not there. The heating and cooling system is in very poor shape. One room may be 90 degrees, and the room next door is 55 degrees because of our system and the upgrades that are needed. We're asking for money to renovate our dorms to make them more accessible and ADA compliant. Our annual request of asset preservation money, that is ongoing maintenance of our buildings. In the past, it was a challenge to get that money because a small problem could become fixed very quickly. But as our problems became bigger, it is harder to maintain, and the cost has increased for those problems. The last part is a small change to law 125A.71. That is, once in a while, our community uses our property for meetings, workshops, other things. We are able to use that money that we receive for professional development for our staff. Because the law states the exception is for land and residential rental, in the past, that was established because we had apartments on campus and we received rent. That money would go back to the general fund in the state. We do not have access to that. Currently, we don't have any apartments. Once in a while, parents come and stay in some dorm areas. We would like to have the language changed so we can access that land and residential rental properties, therefore increasing our professional development for teachers. There are other bills that are out there that are related to our school. One of them is in the Department of Transportation. They're establishing a sign, an I-35, to show where we are. That bill is hopefully going through process. It was passed last year, but was vetoed. So we're hoping that bill will pass through this year. Also, we are encouraging the support of a blind and visually instruction program to be established. As the tier licensure is, Representative Erickson has stated, we want to grow our own teachers. We want to have them move up in that tier process. But in the state of Minnesota, we have no teacher program for blind and visually impaired teachers. There isn't one in the state. They have to go out state to receive their blind visually impaired teacher license. That way they're not qualified. So there's more barriers for our teachers. We're trying to figure out how we can establish a program within the state of Minnesota in the post-secondary option to prepare and train our teachers to be more accessible for blind and visually retired. In the next 5 years, we will have a huge shortage. Many of our teachers are up for retirement, and there's no more teachers coming into the state. So there is an urgent need to begin that blind and visually impaired teacher program. I know that's a lot of information in a short amount of time, so I'm willing to answer some questions that you may have, and I am available anytime. If you'd like to visit our program, come and ask questions about us, you're more than willing to do that.
Superintendent, thank you very much. Members, I apologize, we have gone over time, but out of respect for the unique educational opportunities provided by the State Academy, our unique relationship with the State Academy as an agency, and the fact that the superintendent was good enough to travel here today, I wanted to give him the time needed to present. Dr. Kinkle, my apologies. He's been good enough to agree to come back another time to present for the Board of School Administrators. And with that, members, we are adjourned.